Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome back our speaker for today, Professor Simon Platt, based at College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Georgia. Thank you, Simon. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Okay, well, welcome to the next installment of the Neurology Club, the use and misuse of steroids in neurology. Now, we put this talk together to review some of the actions of steroids and how they play a role in nearly every neurological disease. They are extremely valuable as a type of medication, obviously in neurology for multiple reasons, as we'll go over. But in some cases, they are more valuable than others. So I feel that it's worthwhile us looking at their indications and contraindications and the evidence behind this. So we know that they are very commonly used. It's an everyday medication for us, not just in neurology, but in other areas of veterinary medicine. There is sometimes a concern that we overuse this medication, but I feel that because of their tremendous properties, not least in the area of inflammation, that they should be used, but be used with caution. Now, they do affect nearly every tissue in the body, not least with their effects on metabolism of carbohydrates and protein and lipids. And the drugs that we use, which are corticosteroids, vary with their potency, the route that we give them, how much we give them, and obviously they vary dependent on the individual patient that we use them in. There is very little evidence in most neurological diseases for how we should use them in terms of the highest dose recommended and the longest period of time that we can use them. But we have some recommendations based on some studies that we'll present to you today. It is important to go over, unfortunately, the physiology of this drug. I say unfortunately because this can come across as a bit dry, but it's important for us to know what is going on with these drugs. They are obviously derivatives of a naturally produced substance, and that is by the adrenal cortex, and that's cortisol. So a glucocorticoid which has effects on, as we say, carbohydrates, on lipids, in protein metabolism. These drugs will move just passively into the cells and bind to receptors in those cells. And dependent on the species, dependent on the tissue and cell type, those receptor numbers and their sensitivity will vary. We know that there are not as many receptors in feline tissues as there are in canine tissues, for instance, and so the doses which we require to be used for certain conditions are slightly different. We'll briefly touch on that as we go through this presentation. Once the receptors are bound, they move into the nucleus. Well, they'll modify gene transcription. Essentially, then steroids will change the genetic production of the cell, usually of proteins, and most of the time it's with upregulation. Occasionally, they can downregulate. So they'll increase the amount of protein that's produced in a specific cell. When we talk about their effects, we cannot talk about them without mentioning the modification of inflammation that takes place when we use these drugs. And there are pronounced effects on the inflammation cascade and also on immune function, and they often overlap. So even at anti-inflammatory doses, there's going to be some effect on immune function and vice versa. So we can see here from this diagram that we have an effect on many cell types. So there's a reduction of eosinophil numbers. There's a reduction of cytokine production from T lymphocytes. There is a reduction of mast cell numbers. There's a reduction of cytokine production from macrophages. So we can see that that's a tremendous impact on inflammation and a little bit on immune function. Because it's going to knock out or reduce at least cell-mediated immunity, as well as humoral immunity, but more so cell-mediated. And there's also effect on the structural cells around the body, reducing endothelial cell leakage, which helps with edema, as we'll mention later, reducing epithelial cell production of cytokines and inflammatory mediators. So we can see there that there's multiple effects that these drugs will have on tissues via their effects on cells. There are, as we already know, well-documented effects on the body, which can be viewed as side effects or adverse effects. And this human diagram can help us a little bit with that. But in summary, to the side, we've got things that we know of that may be more mild, less long-term health issues, such as increased appetite, although that will lead to weight gain. This water and salt retention leading to swelling and edema can affect, therefore, blood pressure. We know because of the predominant glucose saving and gluconeogenesis role of steroids that it can predispose to diabetes and therefore can result in cataracts as well. Because of the protein breakdown, it can result in muscle weakness and thinning of the skin because of the effects on the immune system. There may be increased susceptibility to infection at higher doses. There are effects, obviously, on the GI system, which can be a most serious end, resultant in stomach ulcers. There are also effects on the central nervous system, and these are psychological effects. And some people even suggest that steroids might be pro-convulsive, and so we need to be concerned about that. However, as we might get into, there are some recent work that suggests that seizure effects on the brain may be reduced by anti-inflammatory doses of steroids. So there are some direct and indirect effects on the nervous system of steroids themselves. And then we also know that there is an effect on the adrenals directly, and potentially in the worst case scenario that can lead to an adrenal crisis. The type of glucocorticoid you use will determine the amount of in anti-inflammation strength that it has, as well as mineralocorticoid activity. As we can see at the baseline here, we have hydrocortisone, which has a standard anti-inflammatory potency, which every other drug is compared to, of 1, and mineralocorticoid of 1. We can see that prednisone and prednisolone have 4 times the anti-inflammatory potency, methylpred 5 times, and dexamethasone 30 times anti-inflammatory potency. It is important to note then, if we ever use dexamethasone for its anti-inflammatory role, which is common in our practice, that we have to use it at 8 times less the dose of prednisone because of the differing potency. So roughly 8 times less the dose. So if we're gonna use prednisone at 1 mg per kg, we're gonna need to use an eighth of a mg per kg for the same inflammatory potency when we use dexamethasone. Fludrocortisone is not as commonly used, but has about 10 times the anti-inflammatory potency of hydrocortisone. So important to know those things because that results in differing doses that we end up using. You'll often see that these preparations will be accompanied by a combination of drugs and that will result in varying solubility. So we have sodium phosphate extensions of the drug, hemisuccinate extensions of the drug, for instance, which make them more water soluble, and that means a more rapid absorption. Those that are accompanied by acetate and diacetate make them poorly water soluble, so are more depot type drugs. And in terms of anti-inflammatory, we've gone through a little bit of the mechanism of action of there. We often will use an anti-inflammatory dose of 0.5 to 1 mg per kg per day for dogs. And as we said, because cats have less receptors, then we can use a higher dose. They're a little bit more resistant to steroid side effects because of this as well. 1 to 2 mg per kg per day for cats is anti-inflammatory, whereas towards 2 mg per kg per day for dogs is considered immunomodulating. Usually we can go with once a day. There's no reason to split it up unless there's GI irritation. And if the animals are eating then it is acceptable to go with oral. There's no real reason to go with injectable steroids if the animal is able to ingest a dose. So let's talk about the diseases that we can mention. Many of these we've covered in depth in other webinar sessions. Sorry, let's go back a second. We've covered them in other webinar sessions, but we're going to review the role of steroids specifically in these conditions, kind of from start to finish. So won't be new material in terms of the diseases we're talking about, but the role of steroids will be clarified here. And we'll start with V for vascular disease. And we'll talk about two things. We're going to talk about stroke, and we're going to talk about hypertensive encephalopathy, a new area in neurology that's being recognized due to increased blood pressure on an acute or chronic basis. So when we first talk about a stroke, we have to just clarify that we're talking about a cerebrovascular accident resultant many times from cerebrovascular disease. So some disease of the blood vessels. This can be a chronic disease, which seems to be more common in people due to cholesterol issues and high blood pressure on a chronic basis, resulting in thinning of the blood wall and ultimately some type of issue reducing blood supply to the brain, or even an obstruction of one of the blood vessels to an area of the brain. So these are the two things that we can see: a vessel occlusion or obstruction, or vessel leakage. The vessel occlusion is often a thrombosis, so that's a local occlusion due to blood vessel wall thickening, or an embolus, an area distant to brain vasculature. Has some type of coagulum develop, whether it is due purely to blood or it's infectious or parasitic or neoplastic, and it breaks off and then lodges in a blood vessel in the brain. That causes ischemic stroke, and that is a reduction of blood supply to a specific territory of the brain. Large vessels, it's called territorial stroke. Small vessels, it's called lacuna stroke or small vessel stroke. Vessel rupture or leakage, this is hemorrhagic stroke, and this often occurs within the brain and occasionally in the subarachnoid space or outside the brain. So ischemic stroke, an area of the brain supplied by a blood vessel is damaged, and hemorrhagic stroke, a blood vessel essentially leaks in a certain area. So a territorial infarct can be seen here on MRI, a large vessel stroke. Ischemic stroke, you can see the sharp boundaries here, and then we see here again a large vessel stroke. These are middle cerebral artery strokes. Lacuna infarction, small vessel strokes. We can see here again just very sharp line on the midline, a little less well defined here laterally, and these are usually due to obstructions of perforating arteries of the rostral brainstem or striate arteries, so deep-seated vessels. These are end vessels, really, with no limited collateral circulation. So what is it that we should be thinking about with the use of steroids when we talk about stroke? Well, certainly we've got an onset of edema after the stroke, but unfortunately, most of the time, then we are actually seeing an edema which is called so-called cytotoxic, and we'll get into this more with head trauma. But cytotoxic edema is a loss of energy, is due to a loss of energy supply to the cells, and the cells will then lose energy to the specifically to the sodium and potassium pumps, and water will build up within the cells. So that's cytotoxic edema, and that's less responsive to steroids than vasogenic edema, which is breakdown of blood vessels and a leakage of fluid out. There have been no studies in this area in veterinary medicine, and so at this stage we go with what is noted in human medicine. This may not be justified, so we have to take what we're saying here with a pinch of salt in terms of the validity, but at this stage, glucocorticoids have not been shown to alter the size of an infarction or hemorrhage. They probably do not increase, or sorry, do not decrease intracranial pressure due to disease as well. And so, in human medicine, the benefits of steroids are actually questionable. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't consider using them. It's just that we don't have evidence to say they need to be used. Now, the other type of vascular disease where steroids may help is hypertensive encephalopathy. Hypertensive encephalopathy is, as the name suggests, a disease of the brain due to increased blood pressure. Now, that can be on an acute basis where you get a sudden increase of blood pressure over 30 millimeters of mercury at one time, and that can cause blood vessel damage, or a more chronic blood pressure change where your blood pressure is constantly elevated above 180. And this is well documented in people and results in a syndrome called posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, or PRESS. This is essentially a situation where blood vessels become damaged by increased blood pressure, the systemic hypertension, and results in leakage of fluid, so more vasogenic edema into the surrounding white matter most of the time. Many times in people, there's an underlying process leading to this, an underlying reason for an increased blood pressure, but we don't know that in dogs and cats at this stage. But the documentation of brain disease in the presence of elevated blood pressure is enough for us to say that we could suspect this disease. On MRI, as we can see in this case, you'll see symmetrical changes which indicate edema, often in the white matter, but occasionally in gray matter structures as well. And that edema can respond to anti-inflammatory doses of steroids. Ultimately, the hypertension needs to be treated, and this condition therefore can be reversible in that situation. And the reason for the hypertension needs to be investigated or addressed as well. Most of the time, as we said, the pathogenesis of this involves really blood vessel damage, and it's the edema that can be treated, and it's this edema that has a predilection for white matter. The reason it's more what is called posterior or back of the brain encephalopathy in people is supposedly due to the fact that the blood vessels in the back of the brain don't have as much autoregulation associated with them, and so any elevation of blood pressure leaves those blood vessels predisposed to leakage, and that leakage can be mopped up with the use of steroids. So overall, for vascular disease, there's no real evidence for stroke being something which can benefit, but there's no contraindication. And for hypertensive encephalopathy, it may just be a symptomatic treatment, but it is something that could help out. When we talk about vascular disease in the spinal cord, we often think of ischemic myelopathy. And for ischemic myelopathy, most of the time we're thinking about fibrocartilaginous emboli, or FCE. And as we know, this is where a small piece of nucleus pulposus will somehow make its way into the vasculature inside the spinal cord. Often, this is in non-chondrodystrophic breeds, but it's not 100% of the time the case. Somehow, that nucleus pulposus will make its way into a blood vessel that may have asymmetric supply to the spinal cord, so the disease can manifest clinically asymmetrically. Because it's blockage of a blood vessel, much like stroke in the brain, it results in local ischemia, and that can result again in cytotoxic edema rather than vasogenic edema. It's often non-progressive. The diagnosis is by clinical signs and by MRI, and on MRI here we can see hyperintensity within the spinal cord here. No compression of the spinal cord, normal disc structures on the outside, and usually a normal spinal fluid tap analysis. There is no specific treatment, and at this stage again, there's been no benefit noted with the use of steroids. Most of the time, if this is the case, if this disease actually is present, then there is no pain evident on palpation. We could have a similar presentation of a per-acute onset of disease due to disc rupture, and that can be hydrated nucleus pulposus extrusion rupture. We'll talk about that just a little bit later in the session, and that may benefit from steroids because we've got a more vasogenic edema. So we can see here with vascular disease that should we have vasogenic edema, there may be a benefit of steroids. If we have cytotoxic edema, there is limited to no benefit of steroids. Now let's talk about an area where we know that steroids can have some role, and that is in neoplasia of the brain particularly. We know that we've got a conservative option or palliative option for brain tumors, which is where steroids play a role. And then with the more definitive therapies that are on offer, surgical debulking, radiation therapy, and to some extent chemotherapy, then steroids are really just an adjunct, particularly reducing the adverse effects that may be associated with surgical manipulation of the brain and with radiation side effects. We know that steroids at anti-inflammatory doses can improve patients quite rapidly. So within 72 hours, sometimes quicker, they can show dramatic clinical improvement. And this is often because it will reduce the associated vasogenic edema that's seen with brain tumors. But it also is due to the fact that this will reduce brain tumor volume, or the anti-inflammatory dose of steroids will reduce brain tumor volume, and it will reduce CSF production. So there is a direct effect on the brain tumor itself, not just on the surrounding edema that's often present in the white matter. So the reduction of clinical signs can actually be a help to us because we can see what is likely to be permanent due to the brain tumor itself and what is likely to be temporary. So we will always offer anti-inflammatory steroids to dogs with suspected or confirmed brain tumors. In addition, we can't rely just on steroids for the symptomatic palliative treatment of brain tumors, so we'll often add in diuretics to reduce CSF production. We'll talk about this more with hydrocephalus, and we'll use anticonvulsants if they're warranted. The resultant effect on the patient in terms of survival is a bit difficult to predict because we know in veterinary medicine survival is determined by an owner's wishes. So the studies that are out there are thin on the ground and not well constructed. We can see that often we can add an extra 3 months of life by using steroids, but we've seen some patients with brain tumors that have gone out at least a year with steroids alone. So we cannot discount the value of steroids, and we cannot discount the fact that in some tumors which are slow growing, it may be a valid option which is cheap and safe. Now let's talk about inflammation of the nervous system. And we think that there should be a very good role for steroids when we talk about inflammation of the nervous system. But we have to be aware that sometimes that inflammation may be infectious, and so there would be concern about using steroids. Well, let's talk about bacterial disease first. We know that bacterial disease can affect the nervous system, and usually it's a spread from a local site, so from the ear or from the nose, so spreading into the brain. It may be directly introduced after a bite injury, or it may be spread systemically from infection that exists in the skin or nail bed or the abdomen, like pyometra. Multiple organisms can actually be responsible, so we very rarely know at the time of clinical effect which one it is, so we have to consider a broad-spectrum antibiotic therapy. Many of these patients will be pyrexic and have hematology changes, but it's not necessarily the case. And for some reason, bacterial disease loves the brain more than the spine, but when it does affect the spine, has pus around the spine, then we'll call that empyema. There is a guarded prognosis with this disease. Bacterial disease of the nervous system in dogs and cats is not a good disease. And so we need to be aggressive in treating it. Now, we've talked about antibiotics. In the first few days, we can use multiple types of antibiotics because the blood-brain barrier is wide open. However, penicillin-related drugs, first-generation cephalosporins, are not really valid to be used after this period of time because the blood-brain barrier will often pump them out again. So we have to look for other options. And we looked at for enrofloxacin, particularly if we're looking at gram-negatives. Third-generation cephalosporins will get in. Metronidazole as a great anaerobe. Trimethoprim sulfa, doxycycline are good medications, antibiotics to use. So these are drugs that we can use in combination. But what about the role of anti-inflammatory steroids? Well, the clinical signs of bacterial disease in the CNS, which can be neck pain, which can be swelling of the nervous system leading to herniation and therefore gross changes of cerebral function. Often those are due to edema, either in affecting the meninges or in the brain and neck and spinal cord itself. And so these things can respond. Seems paradoxical that we'd use steroids in the face of bacterial disease, but in people with bacterial meningitis, intravenous steroid use is often the first. It's the first type of treatment that will be used. It has to be used at anti-inflammatory doses, and it has to be used in the short term, so 2 or 3 days only. After that, the effect on the immune system will make these drugs contraindicated. The same for other types of infections, but when we talk specifically, we could look at distempers. Distemper causes neurologic signs by altering immune function. Even in the vaccinated case, distemper is possible in the nervous system. We know in the unvaccinated dog that we get systemic signs preceding often the neurologic signs. But those neurologic signs can be due to immune dysfunction, and that immune dysfunction potentially will respond to immunosuppressive steroids. Many times we'll just use anti-inflammatory. There are no studies out there that suggest what dose we should use, for how long we should use them, and also the success. So we are a little stuck in terms of giving solid advice for the use of steroids with viral disease. We know specifically that they can only help with the consequences rather than the disease itself. With FIP, the viral infection of cats that can affect the nervous system, again, we may have a systemic component to this. It's not always required to have that present, but again, it's a disease that causes neurologic dysfunction by altering immune function in the brain and in the nervous system. And so steroids may have an effect. They may slow granuloma formation. However, there's no evidence of their role. Certainly, we know this is a fatal disease once it gets in the nervous system. So we have little contraindication to the use of steroids, but at this stage, the dose and the timing of their use are unknown. For immune-mediated or so-called immune-mediated diseases of the nervous system, steroids have a greater role. Often these are now called meningitis of unknown etiology or meningitis of unknown origin, and they encompass some of the more specific pathological diagnoses such as GME or granulomatous meningoencephalomyelitis. That's probably the most well documented of all our immune-mediated inflammations of the nervous system, and this is a T-cell mediated delayed type hypersensitivity, so something that is perfect for the role of steroids. We know that we cannot specifically diagnose these in our cases. We can get close with CSF and with MRI, but we are unable to specifically say this without pathology. It can affect cases on an acute basis or a chronic basis. It can be focal or diffuse. And it left untreated, the suggestion is that many of these cases will die and quickly. So the use of steroids is suggested to be vital. Now, in the studies that are out there, which I've documented here, are not well constructed because they're not based on pathological confirmation that GME was present, and they are treated. So these are retrospective studies. They are treated at different stages of the disease with multiple medications, and obviously survival time being an outcome parameter means that we don't have a solid outcome for us to go by. Again, these are going to be determined by owners, but this is what we have to deal with. So it gives you some idea. The use of steroids alone in this very early study suggested 1 to 2 month survival. However, we have seen and some more recent studies have shown that steroids can, on their own, at immunosuppressive doses, can actually benefit these patients for well over a year. So this is the only study really that's out there. However, we know that this underestimates their benefit. Radiation therapy has also been tested. Procarbazine on its own about a year, and then here steroids and cytosine, so immunosuppressive steroids and the use of cytosine or cytoSAR at this regime can result in well over a year of median survival time. Cyclosporine and steroids in a small study, 930 days. Azathioprine on its own, some of these cases had steroids, 1800 days. And so you can see that there are benefits of steroids as an adjunct as well, because they have a different mechanism of action on the immune system than these drugs, cytosine, cyclosporine, azathioprine. So they are synergistic, so to speak, when we're dealing with immune-mediated disease of the nervous system. Another immune-mediated disease of the nervous system, which is a little bit more sinister, is that of the necrotizing variety. And the necrotizing variety are called necrotizing meningoencephalitis, NME, and there's also necrotizing leukoencephalitis, so NLE. These again are pathological diagnoses. They affect more specific breeds, so pugs, Maltese, Yorkshire Terriers, Chihuahuas, and again, they're young in onset dogs. So these are dogs which are most commonly affected, although it can be any age and any breed. There is a familial basis here, and because it causes necrosis in the brain, we can expect this to be less responsive to medication. Necrosis is not going to be something like the granuloma formation with GME that is going to be very responsive to steroids. So this is an immune-mediated disease, may be lumped in the same group of diseases as GME, but are less responsive overall than GME to steroids. So, if we look at treating these inflammations, we rarely know the specific diagnosis, so we end up treating for the treatable. If we have some time on our hands, quite cheesy, then we can go with the use of antibiotics just in case it's an infection and use anti-inflammatory steroids. We look for the effect on the anti-inflammatory steroids, and if we get a positive effect, we will reduce those and just go with antibiotics on the presumption that it is an infectious disease. If we see a negative effect or a lack of effect, we'll either change the antibiotics or we're going to have to then presume that it's an immune-mediated disease. And in well-vaccinated areas of the world, then infectious disease of the nervous system only seems to play a role in 2 out of 10 dogs with inflammatory disease of the nervous system. So many times we are actually looking at an immune-mediated condition like meningitis of unknown origin or etiology. And so if we go to the other side of this slide, we can see that you now have a ticking time bomb type of case where the dog is deteriorating fast, and we have to go with the 8 out of 10 potential that you have an immune-mediated disease. So we'll go with immunosuppressive steroids. And when we look at immunosuppressive steroids, we can again look for a good and a bad outcome. With a good outcome, we're going to start to reduce the dose gradually and look for any potential of relapse, in which case we'll have to go back up to a higher dose. If we don't get such a successful treatment, then at that stage we need to consider that we have to add a second drug. So that would be the case of using cyclosporin, azathioprine, cytosine, mycophenolate, something like that. Or we also have to question our initial diagnosis and advise the owners that this may not be a treatable disease, maybe a necrotizing disease, for instance, or it may be lymphoma and not an inflammation as we suspected. Okay, so let's move on to trauma. And with trauma, we could see multiple roles for the use of steroids. When we look at head trauma specifically, the secondary injuries that occur, things that we can potentially focus on, include edema and as well as ischemia, and then results in increased intracranial pressure. That increased intracranial pressure causes a decrease in blood flow, which causes further problems, often resulting in edema. And edema is, as we said, an area of pathology that can respond to steroids. So head trauma, just from that basic pathophysiology, suggests a role for steroids. The brain tries to compensate by reducing CSF volume intracranially and shunting some blood out with vasoconstriction if we have edema build up in the brain. But there's only so much of the CSF and the blood that the intracranial system can lose. So we need to act quickly if we're going to act with drugs that potentially can buy us some time. So what are those drugs? Well, if we have edema, then potentially steroids can help. And we know that one type of edema does respond to steroids, and that is vasogenic edema. Cytotoxic can also occur secondary to head trauma. Excuse me. But this is cell swelling due to cell accumulation of water within the cell, and this doesn't respond very well to steroids. Interstitial edema, that can respond to steroids, and then these last two are less common subsequent to head trauma. A bit of an illustration really to show us that vasogenic edema is edema outside of the blood vessel. Often this then tracks around white matter tracts, and this is responsive to steroids, whereas cytotoxic edema, this is edema within the cells itself due to a loss of energy in these cells, and this is not really responsive to the use of steroids. So we do see a role if we have vasogenic edema present, much as we discussed a little bit with the vascular diseases. But also we know that steroids will stabilize membranes, inhibit lipid peroxidation, and decrease calcium accumulation. And these are things which can be very valuable secondary to trauma. So it is something which, again, promotes a use of steroids in head trauma, as well as the less well-documented pathophysiology of head trauma, which involves some inflammation. So based on this set of reasoning, a human trial went ahead and looked at using high doses of steroids quickly after head trauma. And this was the CRASH trial. This stands for corticosteroids randomized after severe head trauma. And this trial ultimately was stopped early because the use of corticosteroids were associated with a more negative outcome. And this is because in an acute head trauma environment where we have reduced oxygen supply to the brain, steroids can predispose to lactic acidosis and potentiate neuronal damage. And so steroids at this stage in head trauma, acute stage of head trauma, are actually contraindicated. There are no studies on the role of anti-inflammatory steroids in the subacute to late stages of head trauma, so 3 to 4 or 5 days after head trauma. And we know there must be inflammation present, and there's probably still edema present. So a role of anti-inflammatory steroids in head trauma is possible still. No studies exist, and when we talk about contraindication of steroids in head trauma, it's high doses of steroids in the first 72 hours. Spinal cord trauma, very similar pathophysiology. We have something that we can't deal with, which is primary, first order trauma, primary injury. And this is the physical damage. These are the things which just occur and cannot be usually reversed. But they often lead to the secondary damage, which is where there's a role for medication. Some of the secondary damage, again, promotes the potential for steroid use, in that we have a loss of autoregulation that can lead to edema. And we also have a role for steroids in reducing inflammation that can be secondary to increased excitotoxicity and increased free radical production. So much like with head trauma, there's a potential role for steroids in spinal trauma. The benefits are that, again, you'll reduce vasogenic edema, can actually help restore the blood-brain barrier. It will enhance spinal cord blood flow, stabilizes lysosomal membranes, inhibits endorphin release, reduces inflammation, and reverses intracellular calcium accumulation. So again, multiple reasons, as in head trauma, why glucocorticoids should be useful for spinal cord trauma. In human medicine, again, big studies went ahead to try to prove their role and unfortunately failed to do this. When we talk about steroids for spinal cord trauma, we often look at the high-dose steroid regime that has been documented, where methylprednisolone sodium succinate is used at a high dose initially of 30 mg per kg intravenously, and then repeated 2 hours later at a lower dose of 15 mg per kg, 6 hours later, lower dose at 15 mg per kg, and repeated every 6 hours for either 24 or 48 hours. And these regimes were tested in human medicine and found to only improve finger and toe movement after 6 months and a year. Studies weren't particularly well constructed, and they have come under some scrutiny to suggest that potentially that benefit may not be real. In addition, we know that there are some adverse effects of such high doses of steroids, and in veterinary medicine, that they are the gastrointestinal side effects. So we may be promoting intestinal erosions and ulceration. In veterinary medicine, recent studies have suggested that the use of high doses of steroids, again, are contraindicated because of those adverse effects, and there is no benefit proven. So both in head trauma and spinal cord trauma, the use of high doses of steroids in the first 48 to 72 hours after the injury are essentially contraindicated at present. The use of anti-inflammatory steroids is a separate deal, and that should be used outside of those first 72 hours. However, there is no data to support the use at this stage. Again, just theory that potentially they may be beneficial. When we talk about spinal cord injury, we also need to talk about something that's way more common than the hit by car scenario, and that's the disc extrusion and protrusion. We know that there's several types of disc disease, and type 1 is this nuclear extrusion that we see most commonly in Dachshunds or achondrodystrophoid dogs. It's an acute nuclear pulposus extrusion, secondary to degeneration of the disc itself, where the disc becomes dehydrated and mineralized, extrudes through the annulus fibrosus, hits the spinal cord, and we get concussion of the spinal cord, and then actually compression as well. That's different from the type 2 disc disease that we often see more commonly, either in older chondrodystrophic dogs or more commonly still in the large breed dogs and in humans. So this is the type of disc that we most commonly will experience. And this is annular protrusion. In the annular protrusion, we'll get compression of the spinal cord, but there's no actually extrusion. So we don't actually face the same degree of edema production secondary to the cord being hit or the concussion or contusion that is subsequent to the extrusion. There is a so-called type 3 disc, which now forms two types of discs. Type 3 disc is a misnomer because this refers to there being degeneration of the disc prior to it being involved in spinal cord injury, and where there is no degeneration that results in this as a healthy disc, but it is nuclear extrusion. So we now call this nucleus pulposus extrusion, or acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion, and a subset of this is a hydrated disc extrusion. Both of these types of nuclear extrusion will lead to a non-compressive situation, but will lead to cord concussion. And that results in edema again. That edema, though, may be cytotoxic, so maybe in part, like we'll see, secondary to head trauma and also to the vascular events that we've described earlier today. There is no disc degeneration, as we said, there's no chronic compression here. And this can be seen in any breed and varies in terms of the presence of pain. Secondary to often acute disc disease, we may see progressive myelomalacia. It's said to be present in about 10% of dogs that have acute disc disease. That results in loss of pain sensation. So if you have a dog that you suspect to have acute disc disease that presents to you with paraplegia and loss of nociception or loss of deep pain sensation, perception, then 10% of those dogs can present with progressive myelomalacia, where they may exhibit profound pain, they may be hypothermic, and they may start to progress in their clinical picture so that they lose reflexes in the pelvic limbs, and certainly can ultimately ascend to the thoracic limbs where they lose reflexes and have respiratory compromise as well. So a very serious situation. The underlying pathophysiology of this is not well elucidated, and there has been no role for steroids outlined. However, for acute disc disease that doesn't involve myelomalacia, we know that we have various treatment options. They are either medical or surgical, and most of the time that depends on how severely you're affected, so neurologic status, as well as the economics of the owner. There are some things in the middle which can also determine the effect of treatment and what you use, but most of the time it's how severely are you affected and how much money does the owner have, which will determine whether we go surgically or medically. So we need to know what requires surgery when we're talking about disc disease, and this is often the paralyzed patient. This is often those that have recurrent disease. This is often those that are refractory to pain, and this is often those that are deteriorating the face. Sorry, when I say refractory to medication, still exhibiting pain, and those that are deteriorating in the face of medical therapy. Those are the four types of cases that would require surgery. However, a short-term medical approach is often warranted, and that can involve strict rest so that we don't get further nucleus pulposus extrusion, can involve anti-inflammatory, so you can use non-steroidals, but instead there is a role for low-dose steroids. Again, there's no data to suggest quite what that role is, but the use of anti-inflammatory steroids for several days, taking away inflammation, can be helpful. No more than several days is all that's needed, in addition to their anti-inflammatory and the slight analgesic role. They should be combined with the rest and with muscle relaxants, which can play an important role, but in taking away some of the discomfort as well. So finally, we deal with hydrocephalus, a congenital anomaly that we'll see in dogs of specific breeds most commonly, where we get abnormal dilation of the ventricular system, and where anti-inflammatory steroid doses can actually be quite beneficial in reducing the amount of fluid in the ventricles and therefore the clinical signs on a very rapid basis. We know that hydrocephalus can be congenital versus acquired, and acquired can happen in older age, usually due to obstruction of the ventricles, usually due to tumor or inflammation, maybe even trauma. Occasionally can be acquired due to poor absorption, and this can be in secondary to some nutritional issues or increased production, which is quite rare. So obstruction of the ventricular system by a tumor, for instance, may ultimately increase the fluid buildup in the ventricles, and that can cause hydrocephalus or ventricular megaly. We can diagnose this with advanced imaging. Radiographs aren't so great for the documentation. Ultrasound can help, but CT and MRI is really what is needed to give us an idea of just how large the ventricles are and how much brain tissue is left. And this is important to note because the residual brain tissue is something which is going to often dictate the prognosis, because in this situation, no matter how much steroids can reduce fluid production, they're not going to bring that tissue back. And so often the role of medication in these cases is simply to reduce the predicted progression of the disease rather than dramatically improve the cases, unless some of the clinical signs are due to interstitial edema, whereby the ventricular fluid has seeped into the surrounding cortical areas as well, due to the pressure of the fluid. So we know that medical therapy is the mainstay of treatment of these cases. We try to reduce CSF production, and that's where we'll use prednisone on an anti-inflammatory basis. But also, we don't want to combine this with diuretics, such as furosemide, acetazolamide, and then the proton pump inhibitor, omeprazole, has potential role for reducing fluid production in the brain. Again, anticonvulsants need to be considered as this symptomatic therapy. And if none of that is effective, surgical shunting is considered, again, though, with the residual brain tissue determining the likely prognosis here. Ventricular abnormalities can also be a component of Chiari-like malformation and syringomyelia, in that we can get a blockage of fluid pathways resulting in a backup of fluid into the ventricles. But obviously the main condition here is fluid accumulating in the spinal cord. Again, much like hydrocephalus, there is a role for steroids here. We know that Chiari-like malformation is an abnormality at the back of the skull, a reduced size of the occipital bone, and that may be compressing the cerebellum and changing the flow of fluid within the intracranial cavity. We can see normal structure of the cerebellum here, compressed cerebellum here, and then herniated cerebellum here, which means that we don't get quite the normal flow of fluid out here. This is like putting your thumb on a hose pipe, so the fluid will come out, but that fluid will come out with more pressure. And that fluid will then, when it comes out with more pressure, may end up disrupting spinal cord structure and result in an accumulation of fluid inside the spinal cord. That's called syringomyelia. So Chiari malformation is often linked to a chronic development of syringomyelia. In some cases, syringomyelia then can occur because ultimately the brain is now relatively too big for the skull because of that skull malformation of Chiari, or Chiari-like malformation, sometimes called suboccipital or caudal occipital malformation syndrome. That the fluid system is then obstructed, and that change in fluid flow ultimately disrupts the spinal cord structure. This is seen most commonly in the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, but other toy breeds such as Brussels Griffon, Chihuahuas, Pomeranians have been documented with this condition, which can lead to spinal cord symptoms which are a little unusual, such as scratching and scoliosis, or a bending of the spinal column, a deformity of the spinal column, particularly at a young age, ultimately progressing to pain syndromes, ataxia, and paresis. Not all dogs with a syrinx will have clinical signs, and this is our problem, is because we can only document this with advanced imaging, and we're only going to image those that present with clinical signs unless they go through screening programs. So when we talk about treatment, we have to try to either take the thumb off the hose pipe, which would be a surgical problem, or we end up reducing the buildup of CSF, much like with hydrocephalus. And so we'll start with diuretics, but often we're going to end up adding anti-inflammatory doses of steroids as well. And omeprazole, pain medications like gabapentin, tramadol should also be considered, and surgery therefore being the last resort. So steroids do have a role here in the, as an anti-inflammatory drug, reducing CSF production. So in summary, steroids are obviously a valuable drug. They have tremendous role in reducing edema, tremendous role in affecting inflammation, tremendous role in affecting the immune system. We know that there are side effects, and those side effects often go parallel with the benefits of these drugs. There are limited studies out there confirming the utility of these drugs in neurological conditions, but if used appropriately and being aware of the side effects that can take place, then they do have a valuable role. So thanks for your attention. Hopefully that has tried to summarize what we do and don't know about steroids. There are a couple of questions which we'll address. One is, when should you slowly reduce steroids after initial use to try to avoid the side effects which come with suppression of the adrenal axis? Well, that's a good question. We know that the use of steroids will suppress the adrenal axis, and so a rapid withdrawal of them can lead to an adrenal crisis, similar to Addison's. And so we know that we should withdraw steroids slowly. Quite when we do that is up for debate. However, it's suggested if you just use a few days of anti-inflammatory steroids, then you don't need to slowly withdraw or taper, as people will call it. If you use a couple of weeks of anti-inflammatory and definitely a higher dose of steroids, then you should taper. And again, no hard and fast rules here, but for every month of use, you may want to taper over a week period of time. So go slowly by halving the dose over that period of time. Again, no hard and fast rules, but if you use steroids for more than 2 weeks, then the consideration is that will have affected the adrenal axis, and you should taper their dose. The other question is, what do you use as the immunosuppressive dose of steroids or prednisone specifically? Well, often I'll use for the first 2 days 4 mg/kg/day for 2 days, and then reduce to 2 mg/kg/day for 14 days, and then so on. So after 14 days at 2 mg/kg, I will then use 1 mg/kg probably for 30 days. So when you start an immunosuppressive regime, you're often on steroids for quite a period of time, and that can be associated with the side effects that we've mentioned, but it is something which can be necessary if you have an immune dysfunction affecting the nervous system. Okay, well, thanks for your attention. If any further questions come through, I can address them in time. But hopefully this has, as I say, benefited you in pulling together all of the evidence and lack of evidence that we have for the effects of steroids on the nervous system and its diseases. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Simon for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.